Dunkin' Cold Coffee can be brewed at home in your Keurig coffee maker with Dunkin' Cold K-Cup Pods. Just brew it hot over ice and enjoy flavor that's crafted to serve cold. The home with Dunkin' is where you want to be.
Donald Trump is now the presumptive Republican nominee for president. His only opponent in this race, former Governor Nikki Haley, had vowed to stay in the race through Super Tuesday. And this morning, after only winning the state of Vermont and the city of Washington, D.C., Nikki Haley dropped out. Now, if there was anything truly significant about Haley's campaign, it was the degree to which it was a symbol of dissatisfaction with Donald Trump. Yes, Nikki Haley talked about the deficit and advocated for congressional term limits. But really, the whole point of the Haley Project was to offer Republicans an alternative to the guy with the orange blowout. So when Nikki Haley dropped out this morning, the big question was, who is she going to endorse? You might think this would be the moment for the last person standing between Donald Trump and the complete takeover of the GOP wouldn't just capitulate to Donald Trump and therefore render, I don't know, the entire point of her candidacy moot. Maybe she wouldn't endorse Joe Biden, but wouldn't she suggest that her supporters didn't have to vote for Donald Trump, that there were other alternatives, that the Haley people might put country over party in times like these? As it turns out, that is not what Nikki Haley did.
In all likelihood, Donald Trump will be the Republican nominee when our party convention meets in July. I congratulate him and wish him well. It is now up to Donald Trump to earn the votes of those in our party and beyond it who did not support him. And I hope he does that. At its best, politics is about bringing people into your cause, not turning them away. And our conservative cause badly needs more people. This is now his time for choosing.
Nikki Haley offered up her supporters on a silver platter to Donald Trump. Not to Joe Biden or even RFK Jr. or Jason Palmer, the guy who won the American Samoa primary last night. Not even that guy. She offered them up to Donald Trump. She entreated Trump to woo her people, to make them his in the name of the conservative cause. And that is because if you look at what Nikki Haley's campaign was actually about, it was never about taking on Donald Trump. Not really. It was about, yes, courting voters who were dissatisfied with Trump, but it was also about courting Trump voters, too.
I believe President Trump was the right president at the right time, and I agree with a lot of his policies. But the truth is, rightly or wrongly, chaos follows him.
I personally think President Trump was the right president at the right time. I agree with a lot of his policies. But the reality is, rightly or wrongly, chaos follows him.
I agree with a lot of Trump's policies. I think he was the right president at the right time. Chaos follows him.
Is it chaos follows him, or does he create the chaos? What? I mean, that sounds so passive. Chaos follows him.
I mean, rightly or wrongly, you call it whatever you want to call it, but when you feel it, it's chaos.
Nikki Haley wanted to be the alternative to Donald Trump, but she also wanted to stay in the good graces of the people who supported Donald Trump. And that meant that her candidacy was sort of indecipherable. Haley was the alternative to someone who she couldn't really bring herself to criticize. So what was the point? Well, if there was any certainty in the Nikki Haley campaign, it was that President Biden was too old, that he was very bad at his job, and that he had put America in peril.
I want to make it clear. I'm not being disrespectful when I say that. We all know people over 75 who can run circles around us. And then we know Joe Biden. We can't afford four more years of Biden's failures.
Every time he opens his mouth, he sounds like his mind is closing up shop.
We can't afford to put Americans at risk, and that's what Joe Biden's doing every day.
It sounds like if in the end we have a choice between Trump and Biden, you're choosing Trump. Is that correct?
I think Biden's more dangerous. I think
Nikki Haley thinks that President Biden is more dangerous for this country than Donald Trump. Donald Trump, the man with 91 felony counts to his name, who has said he will be a dictator on day one, who intends to round up tens of thousands of people into camps, the man who wants to essentially destroy the geopolitical order. But Joe Biden is more dangerous. At every juncture where she might have said otherwise, given any opportunity, Nikki Haley has made clear that she is a Republican, she is a conservative before she is anything else. Is it any wonder that she is offering her supporters to Donald Trump? There was never any other possibility, not really. And so what we are witnessing here is the final capitulation. The men and women who have been credited, however questionably, with being resistant to Trumpism are finally showing their hand. Today, the Republican leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, formally endorsed Donald Trump for president. Now, there was a moment right after January 6th when McConnell said explicitly that Donald Trump was practically and morally responsible for the insurrection. But that did not stop Mitch McConnell from enabling Trump before and after, either directly or indirectly, by carrying out Trump's bidding when it was convenient or avoiding comment when it was not convenient. And by the way, when a comment was very much needed and a critical one at that.
Are you concerned at all, comfortable with your party embracing the former president whom you said was morally responsible for the January 6th attack?
Well, I do think we need to be talking about the future and not the past.
Do you think it's appropriate the way that the former president was storing those top secret and classified documents at his private estate at Mar-a-Lago?
Yeah, I don't really have any comments on this whole investigation.
Former President Donald Trump ridiculed McConnell, saying he had a death wish, and he also went after McConnell's wife, the former Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao, with a personal and racist attack. What did McConnell have to say about that?
Well, he said he had no comment. Then I pressed him about that racist attack against his wife. I said, is it acceptable to have that racist attack against Elaine Chao, who, of course, is of Taiwanese descent? And he said, I don't have anything to say about that.
For years now, Nikki Haley and Mitch McConnell have been touted as holdouts, members of a Republican Party that was still based in reality, resistance agents against Trump and the MAGA movement. But the truth is, Nikki Haley and Mitch McConnell never actually did anything to stop Trump, because all along, this whole time, they knew they needed Trump. Haley wanted to win over Trump's voters, and McConnell needed the support of Trump's allies in Congress. And what makes today so utterly disappointing is that neither of them actually needs Trump anymore. Nikki Haley has left the race. She says she's off to life as a private citizen. Mitch McConnell has announced his retirement from public life at the conclusion of his current Senate term. They don't need Donald Trump anymore, but they are still abiding him, still looking to him as the future of their party. The fantasy here of a different Republican Party, of something other than the darkness that Trump represents, is officially over. Yes, you may still know plenty of people who are Republicans and who don't like Donald Trump, but as far as Republicans in power, the people who could have tried to stop Trump from the inside, they didn't. And now they're gone. Joining me now are Brendan Buck, MSNBC political analyst, and Charlie Sykes, MSNBC contributor and columnist. Thanks, both of you guys, for being here tonight. Brendan, I know you have some thoughts, which you've written about so eloquently, today, about what Nikki Haley's candidacy actually was all about. Can you refresh people who are not familiar with your writings?
Thank you. Yeah, look, Nikki Haley, I think, was really excited to be the last person standing in case Donald Trump were to somehow implode. It's not necessarily crazy to think that that would happen. Somebody, as you said, who was indicted 91 times, someone who was found liable for sexual assault during the campaign. But you have to understand what Republican voters want. That sort of chaos, as she talks about, is not a bug, it's a feature. And if your plan is to be there as the savior when Donald Trump implodes, you know nothing about the Republican Party. Donald Trump would have imploded many times if that was going to happen. It never happens. Republican voters like the chaos that comes with him. So she was very happy to sit there for many, many months and really draw no contrast. I mean, to her credit, towards the end of the race, she certainly did. She took a lot of swipes at him. But he was 50 points ahead of her at that point, and there was never any real chance. So it was a confusing strategy to now pivot there at the end and really make yourself quite unpopular with a lot of Republican voters when it could have actually made a difference earlier on, when Donald Trump looked maybe a little more vulnerable, maybe when some indictments came down, maybe when he dodged some debates to really go after him at that point. But she didn't. She waited until the end, until he was very much clearly already going to be the nominee. And as we have seen time and time again, that implosion never happened, and it was foolish to think that it ever would.
Yeah, I mean, Charlie, I wonder if you think it's too harsh to suggest that when people ask the big questions of what happened to the Republican Party, of course fingers will point to Donald Trump. But the enablers, the people who knew better, I feel like are the ones that deserve special credit for that. People like Nikki Haley, who for so long refused to call Donald Trump out and was his only opponent in this race, or Mitch McConnell, who certainly knew better and was his great enabler in the Senate.
Yeah, they never fail to disappoint, do they? No, this is what's extraordinary about what's happening. And I hope people understand that you know, this is a long, it feels like the old story of Republicans caving into Donald Trump, but it's not the same old, same old. I mean, think about how different 2024 is from 2020, what they are now willing to swallow. Not just the fact that Donald Trump, you know, since 2020 incited a violent attack on the Capitol, tried to overturn the election, you know, embraced a big lie, stopped the first peaceful transfer of power for the first time, stopped the peaceful transfer of power, called for the termination of the Constitution, as Brendan mentioned, has been found liable for raping a woman and faces 91 felony counts, including charges of racketeering and violating the Espionage Act. And I haven't even gotten to the massive fraud judgments against him. And yet Republicans are rolling over and embracing him. And Nikki Haley, neither Nikki Haley or any other Republican could figure out, how could they possibly run against this guy? What issues might work against him? Because this party has become so supine. So you're right. You know, Donald Trump is Donald Trump, and I think we see the man in full. But the story here has been the absolute serial failure of responsible Republicans to stand up against him. And as Brendan noted, the fact that Republican voters don't want to return to normalcy. They don't want to move past the unhinged chaos. They like it.
I do wonder, Brendan, being a creature of Congress, what you thought of Mitch McConnell predicating his announcement saying it should come as no surprise. I mean, this is a person who withstood just withering personal attacks on him and his wife from Donald Trump. And here he is. I mean, the humiliation, the public humiliation of Mitch McConnell by Donald Trump was so embarrassing for even people who weren't Republicans. And yet it should not be surprising, in the words of Mitch McConnell, that he's endorsing Donald Trump. What did you make of that?
So when Mitch McConnell went to the Senate floor last week and announced that he was going to be stepping down, he had a great line. He said, "I have many faults, but misunderstanding politics is not one of them." And I think that is absolutely true. Mitch McConnell cares about one thing right now. That is winning back the Senate. And he understands that a divided party is bad, and therefore endorsing Donald Trump is good. He knows that it would be a huge distraction, that he would have to be asked about it all of the time, and he would rather just get that out of the way. He understands that this is what not only Republican voters want, but it is what the rest of his Republican conference is doing. And he understands that if he were to stage a fight within the conference, A, he would lose because voters are clearly with Donald Trump. But also it would distract them from his one and only goal, really, at this point. I think that he could really go either way on who the president is. But if it gets in the way of taking back the Senate and making that be his last legacy item, he's going to do whatever it takes. It's politics. And that's what Mitch McConnell knows best and cares most about.
Yeah, well, they, as Trump says, they always bend the knee. I mean, Charlie, what did you make of... I think Nikki Haley gets credited for taking swipes at Donald Trump in the closing hours of her campaign, but I was remarkably unimpressed by her appetite for actually taking him on anything substantive and suggesting repeatedly through the course of the campaign that Biden was the greater existential threat to America. As far as a formal endorsement, do you expect her to formally endorse Donald Trump at any point?
Well, I think that has to be the default setting, right? Just to assume that these people will bow the knee, because they all do if she wants a future in Republican politics. But, you know, what we are seeing, though, is this this embrace of the sick political logic that does put a party in power ahead of the country. You know, she was disappointing, but let's just stick with Mitch McConnell for a moment. Mitch McConnell knows what Donald Trump did on January 6th. He came very close, I think, to voting to convict him, to spare us this particular moment. The attacks on his wife, the attacks on him. And yet he's decided, as Brendan points out, that this is what he has to do in order to win the Senate. At some point, you would hope that there would be other Republicans who would follow the example of Liz Cheney and say, you know, there are some things that are more important than winning an election. There are some things more important than holding on to this seat. Mitch McConnell is over 80 years old. He's not running for re-election. He has nothing to lose. If there's ever a moment at which you say, this is right, this is wrong, this man poses a danger to the Republic, I have watched him and I know what he will do, this would be the moment. The fact that Mitch McConnell, you know, is so immersed in this political cynicism, this endless loop of search for power, is really a rather pathetic commentary. I mean, it's not new in world history, in American history, that people would do this. But if you want an example of whatever the opposite of profiles and courage is, this would be it.
And we get that news on the day that the RNC is announcing that Trump's lackeys will be installed as co-chairs of the Republican National Committee, and that more than a majority of the RNC members want to use the money they have to offset the bills from Donald Trump's lawyers. That is the state of play on the right side of the aisle. Brendan Buck, Charlie Sykes, thank you guys both for your time tonight.
Thank you.
Lots more ahead this evening. An actual election conspiracy about mules stuffing ballot boxes turns out to be true. Only it was Republican mules. We're going to have more on the wild crop of MAGA candidates coming to a town near you. But first, the Supreme Court has finally set a key date in the coming Trump immunity claim hearings. Law professor and Supreme Court expert Sherrilyn Ifill joins me here on set right after the break.
On the MSNBC podcast, How to Win 2024, political experts, former Senator Claire McCaskill and Democratic strategist Jennifer Palmieri examine the campaign strategies unfolding in this all-important election.
The focus is on the voters that are not necessarily in your corner now.
If Democrats are going to win in 2024, we have to be able to explain what is happening at the border and what the solutions are.
Search for How to Win 2024 wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every Thursday.
It's Monday night. It's Monday, everyone.
We're happy to have you here on this Monday night. Lots of news to get to tonight.
Make more of your Mondays on MSNBC with Jen Psaki and Rachel Maddow back-to-back.
If you were talking to a voter, what would you say to them about why this case matters to them?
Was this the kind of proceeding you would expect in a typical New York DA's case, or does this really feel different?
Inside with Jen Psaki at 8 p.m. Eastern, followed by The Rachel Maddow Show at 9, Mondays on MSNBC. Monday night.
This week was supposed to be the start of Donald Trump's federal election interference trial in Washington, D.C. But instead of proceedings in Judge Tanya Chutkan's courtroom on Monday, what we got was an expedited ruling by the Supreme Court saying states cannot remove Donald Trump from their ballots for engaging in insurrection under the 14th Amendment. And today, the court announced that it will hear oral arguments over Trump's presidential immunity claim 7 weeks from now, on April 25th, which is the very last day of the court's term. Joining me now is Sherrilyn Ifill, endowed chair in civil rights at Howard University. I should also note she filed an amicus brief in the Trump ballot case, which was, of course, recently decided by the court. It's great to see you. Thank you for being here in New York. I'm not going to ask you to tell me the good news because I think it's truly bad news here. The very last day of the court's term is when they're going to hear this immunity claim, contrasted with the relatively quick time frame for the 14th Amendment ruling. How do you interpret that decision?
It's very much consistent with this court's refusal to be moved from the narrative it has tried to create that we are somehow impervious to the politics of what's happening around us. And this is one of their ways of doing it, pretending that they don't understand the urgency, the reason why American voters would want to know whether one of the candidates for president has been convicted of a crime. And so what they do is they just carry on business as usual. And I suspect to their mind, they think that it is carrying forward a narrative of impartiality. They think that we are so deluded that we believe that they are just sticking to the timetable, sticking to the line, not letting politics move them. And we know that that is not true. We know that they can move quickly when they want to move quickly, and they move slowly when they want to move slowly. And so, you know, it's consistent with what they have demonstrated, but it's incredibly cynical.
Yeah. Oh, can I take it one step further and assign some more nefarious, nefarious ends to that, which is, you know, speeding up a decision on the 14th Amendment help Trump. Slowing down the immunity claim helps Trump. I mean, there's a thread here that sort of makes sense if you look at it through a political lens.
Yeah, I don't think the way the Supreme Court has approached the timing of any of these cases suggests taking seriously how much their failure to acquiesce to the urgency of the moment itself undermines democracy and the electoral process.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, particularly with the 14th Amendment case coming the day before Super Tuesday, I mean, one might call that quick. I'm not sure that I would. I would say that their whole approach to that case showed a kind of laissez-faire at the oral argument. I've said they didn't sound prepared. They did the most cursory review of the history, which is why so much of it was wrong. I mean, there's just a lack of seriousness. And I think, Alex, I've said this before, the moment that we're in this country, which is a time of democratic crisis, requires us all to be big. You know, to be bigger than what we were and to meet the moment. And this court, the majority of this court is not prepared to meet the moment. They are scrabbling.
Yeah.
Even the fact that Clarence Thomas was part of the 14th Amendment decision. If you cared about our democracy, the integrity of the court, the legitimacy of decision making, the conflicts abound.
Yeah.
And he should not have been part of that decision. But they can't help it. And then you see the ham-fistedness, right? It's a per curiam decision. No one wants to assign their name to it. There's the illusion that it's unanimous. I mean, I suppose it is unanimous, but it's not really.
Right.
You have the concurring justices who are like given the 1-2 punch and saying to me what has been the most serious, harsh, and I think not really given enough attention statement about what's going on with the majority on that court. And I will say nothing has shaken me as much as the language in that concurrence.
The suggestion that the conservative justices on the court are basically trying to shield future insurrectionists.
I can't even say suggestion. They said
explicitly
the majority attempts to insulate all alleged insurrectionists from future challenges to their holding federal office. Attempts assigns intentionality to that majority. That should frighten all of us. We should be sitting with that, that people say, well, why didn't they dissent? I mean, I would have liked for them to dissent, at least dissent in part as well. But they are telling us in no uncertain terms, as clearly as they possibly, these are not wild-eyed folks. These are their colleagues on the court. And we have seen them try to toe the line, try to maintain relationships, try to be as careful as possible. And when they make a statement like that, if we refuse to pay attention to what they are telling us is happening on the court, that is on us, not on the majority. Even Amy Coney Barrett, the one conservative woman on the court, who, of course, tries to, you know, scold the women by saying we shouldn't air our dirty laundry. But she says even she didn't think the decision had to go that far. The only reason she's telling us that is because they obviously were having conversations behind the scenes in which she, too, was hoping that the guys would be able to control themselves and restrain themselves enough to just issue the decision in the parameters in which they needed to. So you've got four women saying,
ringing the alarm bell loudly.
All going on and saying, well, but it was 9-0 and it doesn't matter. And this is not what's important. And anyway, it's, you know, Section 3 and it's after the Civil War. And it's like there is a bell ringing, folks. Yeah. And they are telling us.
The other part of it that's so profoundly hypocritical is this is the court that ruled in 2013 in Shelby County that Congress did not have the constitutional power under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment to enforce the Voting Rights Act.
Well,
and now in the same amendment, they're saying, oh, it's all up to Congress to enforce as part of
the. They said something a little different, but, you know, with the same result in the Shelby County versus Holder case in 2013. What they did was exactly what they would do if Congress does pass a statute implementing Section 3, which was to say, not quite this way. Don't do it this way. Right. So Congress has a coverage formula for preclearance under the Voting Rights Act and reauthorizes that formula after hearings, after amassing evidence. And the Supreme Court says, no, 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 we don't think that's right. Because we believe, as the court says in that case, the majority, that things have changed dramatically.
Yes, there's no racism anymore, Cheryl.
And now we see the stories in the papers this week, all of the studies that are being done that's showing that the turnout gap has increased again in those places where preclearance was removed. They don't know better. Congress does know better, which is why they have the power. So even when the court concedes that Congress has power, then they proceed to tell Congress how to use that power. In fact, in this decision,
in this one too.
Right, they said it has to be legislation, and that legislation has to specifically say this and that, right? So it's a power grab in every way, and it is deference to Congress in name only. This is the 14th Amendment is one of, to my mind, the most important provision of our Constitution for the way we live our modern lives in this country, our post-Civil War lives. And to see this Supreme Court chip away at it, undermine it, subvert it, take it as their own. The times that that happened in the past, in the 19th century, in the Reconstruction period, resulted in devastation for our democracy. Whether it was Plessy versus Ferguson, whether it was the civil rights cases in 1883, these were all circumstances in which the Supreme Court undermined Congress's power to issue statutes in accordance with the 14th Amendment. And every time they did it, I mean, they ushered in Jim Crow for 60 years in this country. So honestly, when we see the Supreme Court doing this, when we see them subverting a provision of the Constitution that those framers, the only framers in the history of this country who have looked insurrection in the eye and overcome it and stitched back together a broken nation, when we see them do this, we should understand this is an emergency moment for our democracy.
Yeah, and that emergency, we are going to talk in a coming block about just how crystal clear it is and how very much at our doorstep that emergency
is.
Sherilyn, please hang with me if you can for a few more minutes. Still to come tonight, President Biden has a lot to brag about in tomorrow's State of the Union address, a bustling economy and higher wages and lower crime. But when do American voters start giving him credit? Plus, the new crop of Republicans who have molded themselves in Trump's image are coming to a down ballot race near you. That is next.
Stay up to date on the biggest issues of the day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning, you'll get analysis by experts you trust, video highlights from your favorite shows.
2024 is now truly the most important election in the history of our country.
Previews of our podcasts and documentaries, plus written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves, all sent directly to your inbox each morning. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both The Saturday Show and The Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
Let me begin by asking a very simple question. Do we know the truth about what really happened in the 2020 election?
I think millions of Americans know something went wrong.
True the Vote has the largest store of election intelligence for the 2020 elections. We've identified more than 1,100 mules.
What is a mule?
Person picking up ballots and running them to the drop boxes.
This is organized crime.
That was a trailer for the election conspiracy propaganda 2000 Mules. It was created by right-wing provocateur Dinesh D'Souza, and it's been widely cited by election deniers across the country as proof that the 2020 presidential election was stolen. In that trailer, you may have caught mention of an organization called True the Vote. That is a right-wing voter suppression group. 2000 Mules is very upfront about the fact that the main source for their stolen election allegation is research by True the Vote. Now, True the Vote claimed that they had identified secret operatives, so-called mules, who were stuffing ballot boxes with votes. And the filmmakers suggest that that is proof of an election that was stolen for Joe Biden. The claims in that film have been widely discredited. And True the Vote has now been forced to admit in a court filing in Georgia that it had no evidence to back up its claims about ballot tampering there. So after that humiliating admission, you might think that anyone involved in the whole 2000 Mules election conspiracy would, I don't know, retreat from public life. But you would be wrong. Yesterday, Republicans chose this man, Brandon Gill, to be their nominee for Texas's 26th congressional district. Brandon Gill is the son-in-law of the creator of 2000 Mules, Dinesh D'Souza. And Gill was the film's main promoter when it premiered. That alone is an alarming example of where the Republican Party is right now, but it is even more shocking when you consider one of the other candidates Republicans chose to be their nominee yesterday. This is Mark Harris, a conservative pastor who ran for Congress in North Carolina back in 2018. And Mark Harris won that race in 2018, or at least that was how things appeared at first. Because after Election Day, everything changed.
Republican Mark Harris beat Democrat Dan McCready by only 905 votes. But instead of calling the race, officials launched a dramatic months-long investigation into allegations of absentee ballot tampering. Harris denied knowing about any wrongdoing. But just a day earlier, Harris's own son, John, a federal prosecutor, gave emotional testimony, revealing he warned his parents about the political operative they hired, Leslie McCrae Dallas, accused of running an operation that tampered with absentee ballots. Workers for Dallas say they were directed to forge signatures, collect blank or incomplete ballots, and even fill in votes.
North Carolina had to hold a brand new election after it was revealed that a Republican operative had helped steal that congressional race by running, wait for it, a ring of ballot harvesting mules. Yes, mules who collected ballots and filled them in for the Republican candidates and then mailed them in to be counted. In the end, scandal plagued Mark Harris, chose not to run in that do-over election, citing health issues. But there is no shortage of second chances in Republican politics. So yesterday, Republicans in North Carolina voted once again to make Mark Harris their nominee, this time in North Carolina's 8th congressional district. Harris is now claiming that that 2018 scandal was actually manufactured by Democrats to steal the election from him, because of course he's saying that. So to summarize, the guy who promoted the totally discredited ballot mule conspiracy is now a Republican nominee for Congress. And the guy who was tainted by the very real ballot mule election conspiracy, scandal, if you will, he is also now a Republican nominee for Congress. Both men are running in safe seats, and they will likely be elected to the U.S. House of Representatives this November. We're going to talk about the new cast of crazy Republican characters they are likely to join in American government just ahead.
2020, Democrats stole the election from President Trump. The year before, they did it to me. Well, in 2024, President Trump is making a comeback. And so am I.
That was Mark Harris, Republican from North Carolina, who now has a second crack at a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. Harris won his first race for a House seat in 2018, but that victory was overturned when his campaign was accused of election fraud. That did not stop Mr. Harris yesterday from winning the Republican primary for North Carolina's 8th congressional district. North Carolina Republicans also chose this guy to be their nominee for governor, Mark Robinson, the state's lieutenant governor. He is known for denying the Holocaust and calling gay and transgender Americans filth. These are some of the down-ballot Republican nominees this year, not just bad candidates, not just fringe candidates. They are now accurate representations of what the party has become under Donald Trump. Back with me is Sherrilyn Ifill. Sherrilyn, thanks for sticking around. And it's so prescient of you to talk about the sort of fear that should be struck in all of our hearts, mm-hmm. that the liberal justices, the normies on the Supreme Court are saying, we've just made it easier for insurrectionists to run for and hold federal office. I mean, when you look at these How do you look at this crop of candidates who are likely to win House seats, maybe even governorships, in light of that decision that they've effectively made it easier for people who campaign violently against the United States to hold office?
Well, let's go back to the insurrection of 2020. You'll remember there were 10 members of Congress, actually 9 and one representative elect. That was Marjorie Taylor Greene, who had not yet taken her oath, who met with the president and others at the White House on December 21st, 2020, to talk about how they would try to overturn the election and to pressure Mike Pence. So I'm talking about Andy Biggs from Arizona. I'm talking about Andy Harris from Maryland. I'm talking about Matt Gaetz. I'm talking about Jim Jordan. All of those individuals took a deep sigh of relief after the Supreme Court's decision as well. These are people who had prior taken an oath and perhaps engaged or alleged to have engaged in the plans for that insurrection. So first of all, let's talk about those folks who essentially get a pass unless Congress passes some legislation through these very folks who are in Congress.
Right.
Exactly. And then you have a new crop of folks, right, who will be sworn in. The Congress will be sworn in before the presidents, before the electors all meet. So we will have a new Congress at that point. And so we will have people who have taken an oath. And what they decide to do should matter as well. So just think about the effect of this decision, which essentially says, unless Congress passes a statute that does all the things we say it has to do, and that statute holds up, that these kinds of folks are not barred by Section 3. This is so contrary to what the framers wanted, who were so concerned about this spirit of insurrection that they believed still existed in this country. They were not only concerned about the period after the Civil War, they wanted to protect this country forevermore. And this decision has essentially unraveled that and set us up for danger. I mean, if you're a democracy and you cannot protect yourself, and you can't protect yourself from those who would undermine you and from those who would unravel you, you're not worthy of the name. And we are seeing the tools taken out of our hands. You know, people say, well, just vote. Well, we're seeing, you know, voting rights on the chopping block. So all the tools are being taken out of our hand that we need to protect our country. And that's what I find most alarming about this moment.
The other piece of it, independent of the insurrectionists sort of getting run of the inmates running the asylum, if you will, is the surge of Christian nationalism. And I focus here on Mark Robinson, the lieutenant governor of North Carolina, who very well may run the state. He today a video has resurfaced of Mark Robinson saying he wants to go back to when women couldn't vote. This is someone who's called homosexual, trans, people filth. This is someone who believes that feminism was created by Satan. I mean, the injection of a theocracy or the overlay of a theocracy onto a democracy seems deeply problematic on a number of levels.
Well, and it's a perverted theocracy, of course, because I don't know who Mark Robinson thinks he would have been in 1919 before women could vote, but maybe he should ask those who were, you know, in the East St. Louis race riots and race massacre. Maybe he should ask those who were in Tulsa. Maybe he should ask folks who were in Alabama and Mississippi during that period. The part that bothers me, Alex, is that we have a very rich tradition in this country of those who were associated with Christianity, who fought for social justice and change. These are the same people who will quote, albeit just one line from a speech, Dr. Martin Luther King. We think about the people, the civil rights movement was deeply and powerfully affected by people of faith, by, you know, Reverend Shuttlesworth and C.T. Vivian. And all of these were people who deeply studied the Christian faith and who believed in the Christian faith and who were moved by it. And that tradition is part of our country as well. And so to see these people pervert a theology, it's not just that they're using theology, they're using their own theology and they are perverting it to their aims in order to receive power. So I'm waiting for other Christian leaders to speak up in that other tradition that we have in this country and stand pat as well.
Preach is all I say. Sherrilyn Ifill, the great Sherrilyn Ifill, thank you for your time tonight. Really appreciate it. Still ahead, it is a two-man race. We've talked about the Republican in the race, and now it is time to talk about the Democrat. Franklin Foer from The Atlantic joins me to talk about Biden's battle ahead. That's next. Tomorrow night at 8 p.m., MSNBC will have special coverage of President Biden's State of the Union address and his unofficial kickoff for the general election rematch against Donald Trump. In his new piece, Joe Biden's Last Campaign, Evan Osnos of The New Yorker writes that by the usual measures, Biden should be cruising to re-election. Violent crime has dropped to a nearly 50-year low. Unemployment is below 4%. And in January, the S&P 500 and the Dow hit record highs. But the usual measures do not apply these days. Joining me now is Franklin Foer, staff writer at The Atlantic and the author of The Last Politician, Inside Joe Biden's White House and the Struggle for America's Future. Frank, it is great to see you. You are quoted. Passages of your book are quoted in the New Yorker piece. It all comes together in a family affair.
Log rolling in our times.
Log rolling in our times, to quote Spy magazine. I wonder, you know, there's been a lot of talk about the bad polling that came out this week in the Biden-Trump matchup. Bad news for Biden in these polls. What is your experience in reporting out from the inside the White House as to how this administration deals with negative feedback or criticism writ large?
One of the strengths and definitely one of the political weaknesses of this White House is its insular nature, that there's a small group of people clustered around the president. They're people who have been clustered around him for decades, and they have this innate self-confidence about the arc of the Biden story, which is that he goes through these periods where everybody underestimates him, and then he rises from the ashes like a phoenix. And so there's a lot of that that's built into the way that they assess their situation. And then they assume that there's this noise that's happening now. Biden is the incumbent, and so the attention is disproportionately thrust on him. But there will come a point in the campaign where attention inevitably starts to shift to the opponent, and then it becomes a comparison. And then we're back to 2020, and that's a race that they feel more comfortable with, despite all of these alarming signs that we're seeing continually about where this race is headed.
Yeah, you know, the thing about 2020, Frank, I was talking about this with Chris Hayes in the earlier hours, Biden didn't really have to campaign. I mean, not have to, he couldn't. There was a pandemic. And when he did campaign, I was with him on the trail for a number of weeks of it. He wasn't the world's greatest campaigner. That's not to malign his very effective presidency. But I mean, to what degree do they, Sarah Longworth in The Bulwark also made this point, like, to what degree does this White House understand they need surrogates, they need advocates, they need ambassadors, and they need to flood the zone with people who aren't Joe Biden to talk about what he's done?
Yeah, I'm sure that they understand that. And there is this way in which the age question cuts in different directions. So there's the question about his capacity to govern. And I think Evan Osnos said, if you sit and you talk to Joe Biden, you see that he has the mental acuity to do the job. And you could argue even that his wisdom and his age have been a major boon to him as he's gone about being president. And then there's this other question, which is about his stamina and his ability to go out and barnstorm across the country. And as you say, he didn't need to inject that kind of stamina into the campaign in 2020 because of the nature of that campaign. But he has to do it now, and he has to find creative ways to compensate for his own shortcomings as a campaigner.
Do you feel like they are going to try and do anything? I mean, what are your expectations for tomorrow, I should say, Frank, given the sort of state of play? It's the unofficial kickoff for the general election.
Right. So obviously, there's this kind of theatrical part of it about the age question, and he needs to repeat what he did last time, which is that everybody's expectations for Joe Biden are so low. You know, there's this narrative that he's aimlessly roaming around the West Wing, which is just clearly not true. And so if he gives a competent, well-delivered speech, that's one thing. But I think the most important thing is that they need to become masters of their own narrative, that there's an economic story that they can tell. There's a story about America being back that they can tell, as embedded in that passage that you read from The New Yorker. And they need to stitch together all of their accomplishments on redirecting the shape of the American economy, being more active on the consumer front, whether it's credit card fraud, junk fees, the return of American labor, the return of antitrust enforcement, the way in which the state is now acting as an investment bank and claiming the commanding heights of the economy through the Inflation Reduction Act, healthcare, et cetera. It's a story. They need to tell it.
They got a lot to do tomorrow in an hour. Franklin Foer, my friend, it is great to see you. Thanks for your time tonight.
Thank you.
That is our show for this evening.